It is Monday, November 7th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, it's the last day of campaigning before American voters head to the polls. Where do the main candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump stand? Our national correspondent tells us. Kurdish fighters create a headache for the U.S. by launching an offensive against the Islamic State group's Syrian capital. We'll explain why. Beijing deals a blow to Hong Kong independence activists with a controversial legal ruling. And African runners once again dominate New York City's prestigious marathon. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, it's a frantic last day of election campaigning for the Democrat and Republican presidential nominees. Before making her first campaign appearance of the day, Hillary Clinton posted an ad on her Twitter account highlighting controversial remarks made by her opponent, Donald Trump.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
When Mexico sends its people, they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. You got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. Oh, I don't remember. He's going like, I don't remember.
Well, Trump kicked off his PAC day of travels with a campaign appearance in Sarasota, Florida, dismissing talk of people giving him credit for running a potentially losing campaign.
No, I don't want any credit if we lose. I'm not looking for credit. I'm not looking for credit. I'm looking to make America great again, not credit. This election will decide whether we are ruled by a corrupt political class. You've been watching what's going on. Hey, folks, the system is rigged. It's rigged, okay?
So what is the state of the race now? I asked our national correspondent, Jim Malone.
From the polls that we see, a modest but steady lead for Hillary Clinton. Most margins are in the 3 to 5 point area, though I must say in terms of a national race at this late stage, if it's up to 5, that's a pretty significant number. It looks like in the last 5 to 7 days, Clinton has rebounded a bit from an earlier Trump surge. So in the final days here, she's putting some distance between herself and Trump, but many of the key state polls are still close. Trump is within perhaps striking distance. But at this late stage of the race, he would really have to have a big surge at the end, not only nationally, but in these key states, places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, where they are spending most of their time.
Well, speaking of spending time, what is Trump doing this day before Election Day to try to boost support in those battleground states?
He's hitting a number of the key states that will decide the outcome of the race. He's hitting places like North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Trump really needs to win some of the bigger battleground states at stake where the race is very close, place like Florida, like Ohio. He's been leading in Ohio, though the margin there may be getting more narrow by the day. And the other issue here is on the Democratic side, the Clinton turnout machine to get voters out to the polls is considered much better than what Trump has. Trump is really relying on the Republican National Committee. And historically, they're not quite as proficient at getting out those voters at the last minute.
He also says he's got a lot of enthusiasm, too. How much does that factor in?
It could, you know. A lot of the polls show a gap there where Trump supporters say they're more enthusiastic. But we saw this 4 years ago, too. Romney voters were said to be more enthusiastic. But then the Obama supporters exceeded the predictions at the polls. Obama was favored by less than 1 point in the final average of polls in 2012. He won by 4. If we see that same kind of gap this time for Clinton, it could be a much bigger gap. But right now, the race appears to be reasonably close. But Trump really has to run the table, so to speak, win all these close battleground states at the end.
Well, what is Hillary Clinton going to do on this Monday to try to keep her edge in some of these states?
She's really focused on Democratic-leaning states that have gone for the Democratic Party in presidential elections since 1992. We're talking places like Pennsylvania and Michigan. She really wants to nail down states where if Trump were able to win one of them, I think it would upset the apple cart and give him a route to the magic number of 270 in the Electoral College. So to some extent, the Democrats are playing defense here at the end. They're not as focused on typically Republican states like Arizona and Georgia, where she's still reasonably close in the polls.
Thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, speaking with us on Election Eve.
Thank you.
Well, many American voters will cast ballots on Tuesday using machines that experts say are too easy to tamper with. With Russian cyber hackers accused of trying to influence the election, many Americans have been calling for an overhaul of those electronic voting machines. In response, some U.S. researchers have been trying to build voting machines that are much tougher to hack. VOA's Steve Barragona met with some of them.
The next time voters cast ballots for president, they might use something like this.
This is a research prototype. A real one would not be built out of cheap painted plywood.
Dan Wallach is a computer science professor at Rice University. He's building a new kind of voting machine from the ground up because he says many of the systems in use today are alarmingly vulnerable to hacking.
When you have paperless electronic voting machines that have no plan B if they've been tampered with, that raises serious concerns.
But many local governments don't have the money to replace them. So Wallach and his colleagues are building their system with low-cost, easy-to-find components.
There's a cheap inkjet printer and a tablet. Both of these are off-the-shelf parts.
Voters make their choices on the touchscreen tablet. The votes are protected with sophisticated cryptography.
The crypto can do some really great tricks. But if you don't trust the cryptography, that's okay, because we also have printed paper ballots that go into a box.
Voters can see the candidate the computer says they chose. The ballot then goes in the box. Only then is the vote cast. And if there's any question about the electronic votes, the paper ballots are the backup. But security was not the only factor they considered, says Wallach's colleague, Claudia Ziegler-Assemian.
It really doesn't matter how secure a voting system is, that if voters can't vote with it and easily cast their ballot, then yeah, the security is a moot point.
The result is called StarVote for secure, transparent, auditable, and reliable. Wallach says it will deliver much more security for half or less of what current machines do. StarVote will not be ready for this election. The team hopes to have it in polling stations by 2018. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Houston.
Well, it's time for a check of the social media headlines, and Andrew Balchevsky is here with more on that. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
So it's election, right?
It's all election all the time, as it's been for like the last, you know, I always joke with Sarah that it seems like every day there's an election topic that's trending. And today is no different, of course, today being the day before the election.
It's one of the last days, I guess.
Yeah. Right? So it's and I'm confident that we'll continue to see things trending even after Election Day.
But, true.
But before tomorrow, we have hashtag election final thoughts. And this is kind of the chance for people to talk about what they're hoping in this last day before Election Day and happen on Election Day tomorrow. So you see supporters of both sides, Hillary Clinton supporters, Donald Trump supporters, making their final pitches for their candidates. Also supporters of Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. They don't get as much press coverage, but
they don't want to be left out, right?
They don't want to be left out, and their supporters don't want them to be left out. They said just because they may not necessarily have a chance at winning, that doesn't mean you shouldn't support them and get their ideas supported and out there. And there's a lot of concern about voting irregularities, as we heard from Steve's report just now. Counties to watch, different indicators to watch as the night goes on. So this hashtag election final thoughts is kind of a catch-all for everything election related in this 24 hours or less before we start Election Day.
Right. I heard that some people are warning that any irregularities that go viral on Twitter, you need to be careful about whether they're actually true, right?
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about social media is that it does connect people, so we can see these massive lines of people going out to vote. We can encourage people to go out and vote. In fact, the other hashtag trending is hashtag vote IRL, vote in real life, getting people out to the polls. But that is the flip side of it, is that when people put these things out on social media, they're not always true. And so we have seen different rumors and things going around already about different voting irregularities, about misinformation, trying to keep people away from the polls. So it is a double-edged sword. It can be a great information tool and a great way to share these things, but take some things with a grain of salt. Not everything you read on social media is necessarily true.
It's a good lesson for tomorrow. Thank you so much to our social media editor, Andrew Palchewski. If you want to follow him on Twitter, he is at apal. This is VOA. Well, here's some of the top stories right now on voanews.com. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to face Swedish questioning over rape allegation. Oil leaders meet in Abu Dhabi, hoping the market is now at a bottom. Yemeni rebels release an American man. And Janet Reno, former U.S. Attorney General, has died at the age of 78. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Kurdish-led Syrian forces captured a number of Islamic State militant positions in heavy fighting on Monday north of the IS stronghold of Raqqa in Syria. Those Kurdish-led forces announced the start of the offensive to gain control of the city on Sunday, backed by U.S. air power and military advisors. For more on the operation, I spoke with John Hanna, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, and I asked him what the U.S. makes of it.
The U.S. has known for a long time that together with Mosul, Raqqa was ISIS's main stronghold. It was really the, the heart and soul of the caliphate that at some point in time was clearly going to need to be taken down. Now, I think there was a great deal of added urgency since the operation in Mosul began. U.S. and Western intelligence agencies have clearly seen indicators that ISIS's external terrorist operations planning from Raqqa has accelerated in recent weeks in order to try and strike targets in the West, in Europe, and America. So I think there's been an added urgency to getting the operation, the assault on Raqqa, going as soon as possible.
And what's the connection with the Mosul offensive in Iraq?
Well, I think it's ISIS, as it loses ground in Mosul, is clearly looking in various ways to divert the energies and focus and attention of the coalition forces away from Mosul. And if they can do that in places like the assault they had earlier this month in Kirkuk, or if they can do it in terms of external terrorist operations against the West, I think they're both trying to disrupt the operations in Mosul and divert the attention of the coalition, but also to tell their own followers that they haven't given up and that the caliphate survives.
How problematic could it be that Kurdish forces are playing a major role in trying to get ISIS out of Raqqa? These are Kurdish forces who the Turks don't really like. In fact, they regard them as terrorists.
It's a huge problem for the United States. The fact is that we have two allies now on the ground in the fight against ISIS. Turkey on the one side, which is a NATO ally, and the Syrian Kurdish militias, the YPG, who have been the most effective fighting force in combating ISIS, are at each other's throats. They hate each other and to some degree would prefer to be fighting each other than to be fighting ISIS. So for Turkey to have the YPG be the lead element in a U.S.-backed force that is going to go into the heart of Syria and a Syrian Arab city, Raqqa, to gain further prestige and further power and further influence with the United States and the West, I think is absolute anathema, and it creates a situation where there's all kinds of possibilities for conflict and tension in the U.S. operation.
Well, thank you very much to Foundation for Defense of Democracies Senior Fellow John Hanna for sharing your insights on the situation in Syria.
Thank you.
China's top legislature has taken action that could disqualify two newly elected Hong Kong lawmakers for failing to respect an oath of allegiance to the territory's mini-constitution. The National People's Congress, or NPC, issued an interpretation of that Hong Kong constitution, or basic law, on Monday. The reinterpretation said prospective lawmakers must not alter the oath of allegiance in order to be able to take their seats. Well, those two pro-independence activists actually did alter the oath at a swearing-in ceremony earlier this year. Hong Kong's chief executive, Leung Chun-ying, said his government would fully implement Beijing's interpretation.
As the chief executive of the SAR, I have the duty to implement the basic law in accordance with Article 48 of the basic law. I and the SAR government will implement the interpretation fully. Hong Kong is an inalienable part of the country. The Hong Kong people have the duty to uphold national unity, territorial integrity and security, as well as the dignity and interests of the Chinese people.
Willie Lam is an analyst at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that the NPC interpretation is, in his words, a blatant violation of the judicial authority granted to Hong Kong's courts by the Basic Law.
Currently, the Hong Kong courts are processing a similar law related to oath-taking. So the NPC has no legal and constitutional right to steal the march on Hong Kong courts. Even if they are dissatisfied with what the Hong Kong court might rule, they have to wait until the Hong Kong courts have made the ruling before afterwards making protests and so forth. So this very crude and rude affront to Hong Kong's high degree of autonomy regarding the judiciary is a big blow to one country, two systems.
Are you going to be able to fight back somehow?
There is very little that Hong Kong can do apart from holding protests, and we expect there would be larger demonstrations in the coming days or weeks. But by and large, the Hong Kong community is divided. The pro-establishment camp, including the business community, is still solidly behind Beijing. So even though the majority of the Hong Kong legal community who will be holding a demonstration tomorrow is definitely against frequent and arbitrary interpretation of Hong Kong laws by the National People's Congress. Apparently, there is not much substantial that Hong Kong can do to prevent Beijing from exacerbating its blatant interference in Hong Kong's domestic affairs.
Well, these pro-independence lawmakers, now will they not be able to be seated?
The two pro-independence legislators who were deemed to have improperly made out their oath, they would be disqualified from office. It is expected that by-elections for the two now vacant seats will be held in 3 months. If colleagues and comrades of these localist groups fail to be re-elected in the by-election, we expect perhaps further demonstrations and even potential ugly clashes with the police. However, what is happening is also that Beijing is using the apparent rise of localist sentiments and even protests as a pretext to squeeze Hong Kong further, as a pretext to crack down on Hong Kong. We must remember that the issue of so-called self-determination and even pro-independence activities arose in Hong Kong only because Beijing has not lived up to its promises of making Hong Kong highly autonomous.
And that was Willie Lam of the Chinese University of Hong Kong speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people choose a new president. VOA's live election night coverage begins at 2200 hours Universal Time. As events unfold, we'll bring you the finale of this historic campaign from Washington and VOA correspondents across the United States and around the world. Tuesday night and Wednesday morning, you'll hear comprehensive coverage until the last speech is done. It's America Votes 2016 on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. One day each autumn, millions of spectators gather in New York City as the world's best runners take to the streets. The New York City Marathon began in 1970 with 127 competitors and has since grown to 50,000 participants from all over the world. Tina Trin met with the race's big winners.
Are you ready? Are you ready to run?
On a brilliant autumn morning in New York City, the world's elite runners pounded the pavement to the cheers of fans gathered from near and far. The TCS New York City Marathon had officially begun.
We come every year. Yeah, we always come cheer everybody on, and it's a lot of fun.
Leading the women's pack was defending champion Mary Kaitani, a petite Kenyan whose diminutive stature belied her commanding stamina. If she succeeded, it would be her third consecutive New York City Marathon win. A few days before the race, she spoke modestly about her prospects.
It's not easy, but for me, if I do it, I think I'll make the history, and for me, it would be nice.
For Kaitani, running was just another day at the office.
I have no job, so my job is actually running. So I have to run in order for my kids to be well.
Fellow Kenyan Lucas Rotich was also thinking about his children back home.
My daughter really like me to go home with her presents. So not only a present, but also something to show him that this is what I got in the race. And that's what's making me to really work hard.
Rotich also knew his daughter wouldn't be the only one watching.
All of the Kenya are watching New York. And I think they don't want to be disappointed. We are representing our country.
Ugandan Moses Kipsiro was running his first New York City marathon, but remembers New Yorkers' energy from a previous race.
All the way, the people are cheering and, coming towards the finishing. You get a lot of support and, it was something so special that I keep remembering it.
In the end, Kaitani got her third win and Rotich came in second. Gurmé Gebrselassie from Eritrea became the youngest ever at 20 years old to take the men's title. Whether runner or spectator, the day's victories were shared by all. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
Well, that's it for International Edition. Just to let you know that you can hear all the latest election night news from our global team of reporters on the Voice of America. There are several ways to listen. Tune in at your regular station or go to voanews.com and hit the Listen tab or catch the live stream on the VOA Now Facebook page. Our coverage begins at 0 hour Universal Time. Well, your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Dan Crafton. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to find me on Twitter, my handle is @Michael_Lippin. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Ross Sea is a vast and remote area of water and ice in the Southern Ocean off the frigid coast of Antarctica. It is also home to an unusually diverse and rich ecosystem, unique in its climate and geography, and one of the last remaining areas on Earth that remains unspoiled by human activity. It is home to a wide variety of deep water species, and unlike nearly every other sea or ocean on our planet, its top predators, whales, seals, penguins, and seabirds, are still abundant. Precisely because life is still abundant in the Ross Sea, it is in danger of exploitation by humans, particularly by commercial interests, and at risk due to the impacts of climate change. That is why on October 28th, 24 states, including the United States, China, and Russia, as well as the European Union, created the Ross Sea Marine Protected Area, or MPA, at 1.55 million square kilometers, the world's largest ocean sanctuary. The Ross Sea MPA is designed to be a natural laboratory for valuable scientific research to increase our understanding of the impact of climate change and fishing on the ocean and its resources, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. This means that as of December 2017, when the agreement enters into force, the Ross Sea will be protected from nearly all human activity. 72% of these waters will be off-limits to commercial fishing, while in a few areas, some fish and krill may be harvested for scientific research. Other human activities will be strictly limited. The creation of the Ross Sea Marine Protected Area is an extraordinary step forward for marine protection, said Secretary of State Kerry, and it did not happen by accident. The creation of the Ross Sea MPA happened thanks to many years of persistent scientific and policy review, intense negotiations, and principled diplomacy. It happened because our nations understood the responsibility we share to protect this unique place for future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.